One of rugby's great myths is that the forwards are always the unthinking heavy lifters, while the backs have all the brains. It probably comes from a small sample of players back in the sport's sepia-toned past. But times have changed. Sharks CEO Edward Coetzee was a prop, and a very good one at that. He played Super Rugby for the Sharks, for South Africa A, and spent 8 years playing in France for Biarritz. He's anything but unthinking or brainless. And as rugby enters a new post-COVID-19 world, the challenges that the game faced before the pandemic ravaged the planet have become exacerbated by 6 months of lockdown. Previous business models have to be torn up and re-engineered. For the next few years at least, professional rugby in South Africa, and globally too, will be in a precarious position. It will take bold, innovative young leaders such as Coetzee to navigate a way through these turbulent times. I'm Craig Ray, and welcome to the Maverick Sports Podcast this week, where we take a deeper look at the business of rugby with Ed Coetzee. Bonjour, Ed. How are you?
How's it, Craig? Thank you so much for such a lovely intro. I would like to meet the person you were talking about one day soon, please.
Well, Ed, you've done a great job there so far, but obviously this year has been a challenge. Maybe let's just kick off with COVID-19, because I guess that's still the hot topic in the world. We are going to go back to rugby. The local competition's about to start. But at the Sharks, how did you cope with COVID-19? What contingencies did you put in place? Because there's no textbook that it could have prepared you for this, is there?
Yeah, Craig, it's been unbelievably tough. And I think it's been unbelievably tough from the point of view that it was for the first time, a crisis that was faced by the world. So there's not a preceding solution to this issue we're facing, So no one knows the extent of it, how long it's going to last, what the financial impact really will be. And I think from that point of view, it was extremely tough. And also, like on the field, we were hitting our straps with quite a young Super Rugby team at the time, and we were leading the comp. So from that point of view, we were excited. And then we got COVID, and financially, obviously, it had a huge impact on the industry. And we immediately took measures to try and minimize that impact without really knowing how long it will last and what the true reality of the situation will be. So it has been challenging, but I think we've managed it reasonably well.
The start of COVID, no one knew how long it would last. I guess that was another big issue. It's how long is this piece of string? Budget probably could allow for a month or two of no sort of income stream or fan income at the stadium through the gates, but that extended into 6 and 7 months. You had to probably be quite flexible, I'd imagine, as a leadership in terms of adapting your strategies almost weekly.
Yeah, I think, often you go into an executive role in a business and, you've got your formal education background that you can lean on, but you actually just find your own groove and manage your business from a day-to-day basis. But I think when something like this happens, you've actually got to go back to proper financial controls and structured finance and make sure that you're managing it as per the book. Also, on another thing that becomes extremely important is your stakeholder relationships, because your relationships with your staff has got to be strong, because there's a level of trust that now immediately becomes, because anxiety sets in, because people aren't sure what their livelihood's going to look like. Mm-hmm. And then also sponsors, and our industry sponsors, season ticket holders, suite holders. So yeah, there's a lot of relationships. I think the key to keep this whole thing together is a relationship thing too,
And again, you can learn the sort of theory of that, but that comes down to personalities and personal relationships. We can get into a little bit more of the detail, but going back to the beginning, certainly from the outside looking in, South African rugby generally handled it pretty well. There was immediate sort of action to start a collective bargaining agreement talks, because it became quickly apparent that, at the very least, salary cuts were going to be part of the future to sustain the industry through this time. And, through the various stakeholders, my players, SA Rugby itself, SARIO, the employment organization, South African rugby as an industry, not just the mother body I'm talking about, came together and really quickly came up with a collective bargaining agreement that looked like everyone bought into. There might have been some people unhappy or not, but generally speaking, it was well managed. And I think it's probably saved the industry a lot more harm over these last 6 months. What's your take on the collective bargaining agreement?
Yeah, Craig, you're 100% right. I think, these things are never easy to do. So there was a strong leadership from South African Rugby. But, your initial reaction when you come to the table in a situation like this is to protect your own interest, And I think there's a lot of that had to give way.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of uncomfortable conversations and honest conversations to be held. But I must admit, I was really heartened by the way that South African rugby steered through this thing as a collective, because this could have destroyed the professional game that would have destroyed the amateur game, you know. And I think just the way it's been done, and with us returning to the field on Saturday, it looks like we've managed this crisis, you know, even though there will be some long damage to our structures. But I think we came through this okay. We'll be all right.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, income is down. The rugby industry had budgeted to cut 1.2 billion rand, you know, in terms of savings this year. That might be slightly less if the rugby championship goes ahead and this domestic competition, the Currie Cup / Super Rugby competition that's going to go ahead. I guess that means broadcast revenue opens up a little bit more. There's a little bit more money in your coffers as a union. Is that quite a relief, especially at this time of the year?
It is a huge relief. I think there's various aspects to why this is a relief. Obviously, financially, there's the hope of some relief on that side. But then also, you know, if you manage a team and you've got talented youngsters that are a generation that aren't the most patient generation around, to get them back playing and back active and give them their purpose and significance back, you know, because I think for professional sportsmen, they've driven quite a lot through what their purpose is, you know, like their purpose are to entertain and to be the best they can be. And if you take that away, a lot of the guys found it difficult. And I think from that point of view, it was quite heartening to just get the green light first to return to train and then to play. Because from a sponsorship and finance point of view, you know, you're dealing with one person on the other side. And, you know, like our sponsors have been unbelievable. They've just been so supportive, you know, and it just shows you that sport is a true unifier, because they didn't let us go. They didn't just turn their back on us, and they committed to see us through this this time. So I think from that point of view, it was heartening. And my biggest challenge I found was just to keep the players' mental state looked after, because, you know, like, you don't want to lose one of them. So I think from that point of view, we're excited that the boys are back.
Well, that mental state, early on in the collective bargaining negotiations, there was the 21-day clause inserted into the negotiations where players could leave. You know, they had 21 days to perhaps find alternative employment. It was highly unlikely that too many were going to jump ship because there weren't that many jobs going as the world shut down. But was that a particularly stressful period for you? Because, you know, you probably have some very key players that might have attracted some big offers from overseas.
Yeah, that was horrible. Eh? And, you know, the thing is, immediately when something like that happens, you know, it breaks a trust relationship. And my first thing with the players was to let them know that they haven't done anything wrong. You know, no one's asked for the situation to come about. No one has asked for COVID to hit the industry. You know, the salary reductions are a necessary evil. And the fact that my players organized a 21-day window, you know, isn't the players' fault. So we encouraged open conversation and we encouraged transparency around that and tried to see within the strict lines of that collective that didn't allow us to pay any discretionary bonuses within the period, how we could keep them happy. You know, and I think our personal relationship that we've built up over the last bit with the players helped us. And yeah, I think we're one of the franchises that are really happy with the result of it. You know, we lost one player in the 21-day window. We're at a stage I was nervous about 11.
Wow, that would have been disastrous. I suppose I did speak to my players at the time, and they said, in theory, all 717 players on their books could have gone in that 21-day period, theoretically. Of course, it was never going to happen that way. But they were also kind of nervous. But I guess it was that negotiation and the give and take you were talking about earlier. You know, it wasn't easy, but it was something that had to be inserted in there to try and, you know, give the players some sort of out if they felt that, you know, the situation was too harsh in South Africa.
Yes and no. And I mean, I did have the discussion with my players at the time and I saw their point of view. But, you know, we were the only country that had a window. I mean, we were probably the only country that was really exposed because of our currency, you know. So from a point of view of how many players could have left, yeah, I agree with you, not 700 players would leave. But our focus will be on 10, you know. So if we lose only 10, but it's our top 10, you know, it destroys our industry, our business. And we might lose sponsors because, you know, sponsors want to be associated with winning teams, with high-profile players like Mapimpi, Nkosi, Bosch, you know, Thomas Atoy, those type of players. So if you lose them, that can adversely affect, over and above COVID-19, your sponsorship revenue.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of players and the economic climate, I mean, South Africa is and has been for the last decade or more. I mean, you yourself played overseas for many years, has been a net exporter of talent, really, because of the currency situation mainly, but yeah, for various other reasons. Do you see a post-COVID world as we sort of stumble into this post-COVID world? Do you see that changing a little bit because Northern Hemisphere clubs maybe aren't as well healed as they might have been pre-COVID?
Craig, yeah, I think the quantum of players that are leaving, I think might go down, just because of basic economics. You know, there's also local player quotas in France, for instance, where they've got a system called the GIF that caters to players that come through their local academies that has to play in the 23. So that is clamped down quite severely on the number of foreigners they can have in that league. And then I do think there will be a correction in the market for the top players. You know, I think you'll always have the marquee players that will attract big salaries. But I do think for a period of 3 to 4 years, there'll be a correction in the market because a lot of those clubs are running artificial business models, you know, that's not actually sustainable. And I think a pandemic like COVID-19 will expose that even further. And I think that, to me, I expect a slowdown in the number of players going, a slight correction in the market for what they will pay for the players. But I do think where our risk always is our high-profile players, and they'll always attract a big contract.
Yeah, you're talking about those models, the European model, they're not necessarily sustainable businesses. I presume you're referring there to the sort of rich benefactor who owns the club and pumps in his own money. And, you know, as long as he's interested or she's interested, that's great. But if they lose interest, the actual business isn't sustainable. Is that what you meant by that?
Yeah, correct. I mean, if you take an example, when I went overseas to France in 2005, I played for a club called Biarritz. We won the French championship in that period over three times. We played the Hunter Cup final twice. And our benefactor was a guy called Serge Kampf, who started a company called Capgemini. And at the time when I arrived in France, Racing Metro was in second division, Toulon was in the second division, Bordeaux was in the second division. And Béziers, Narbonne, all those teams were powerhouse teams, you know. And unfortunately, Serge Kampf passed away, and Biarritz lost their money, and they found themselves in the second division now. So, you know, there's this artificial, I mean, if you look at what's happening at Montpellier, for instance, Mode Altrad, who's, I think, got the third largest fortune in France, he funds Montpellier. And, you know, Montpellier is now a powerhouse. So Jackie Lorenzetti at Racing Metro, Murat Boudjelal at Toulon, you know, they prop up the club's finances. And I think that's what I mean with artificial.
Yeah. But I guess that brings us to the South African talk of private equity coming into South African teams and particularly professional teams. We've seen Jan Rupert and Patrice Motsepe at the Bulls. They own 74.9%, I believe. There's talk at Western Province, certainly from a Stormers, the Western Province company point of view. There's this American consortium. A Durban boy, actually, Marco Mazzotti, from Toti, exactly. I actually did ask him why he didn't want to go to the Sharks.
Yeah.
He said, well, he just feels that the Stormers is a more attractive proposition. I wasn't going to argue with him, you know, Table Mountain, I guess.
Craig.
Come on, okay, that's not a done deal, and this probably won't be a done deal given the politics in Western Province rugby. There is attraction, but is it dangerous as well? How do you strike that balance between the sort of rich private equity person who's putting in the money, but still having a sustainable business in the event they walk away?
Yeah, Craig, I think that is extremely important. You know, if you look at the business of sport, you know, I don't know too many sporting franchises that make big profits. So generally you run a break-even budget, you know, and if unforeseen things happen during the year, you know, you can quickly run into a negative. And I think that's where private equity partners are quite important, you know, just for the in case. So that's quite nice. But on the other side, yeah, it's important to, if possible, find a equity partner that's aligned with your culture and your vision, you know, because you often see it in the European clubs where someone will buy a club and their whole culture changes. You know? And I think South Africa, there's obviously like a long history in sport, and also like, you know, post 94. So there's each province in South Africa has got a very distinct culture and a very distinct, you know, way of doing things. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how private equity matches into that, and if it's actually going to change the culture of the game in the country.
Yeah, and I mean it's a big if at the moment. If you know these things happen, and I guess the idea with private equity, as you say, if you're sort of running a break even budget, is I suppose the temptation is there to overspend if you've got 100 million in the bank, because now you can go buy some marquee players because there's this money there. But you know that money could also disappear overnight, kind of thing. So I guess you've got to have financial discipline, even though there might be cash reserves.
Correct. And I think that's extremely important. You know, it is an atypical business. You know, it's not a typical business where, you know, you've got fixed costs that are always fixed. You know, you're almost a victim of your success. If you start with a young team that's relatively inexpensive, after a year of playing good rugby, your team expense goes up by 20%, you know. So it's very hard to do medium and long-term planning in a structure that's got so many variables.
And how do you do it in rugby? I mean, you could sign Dan Carter at his best, comes to the Sharks, and you spend 10 million rand a year on him and he breaks his knee in the first game, you know, for argument's sake. Yeah, how do you mitigate against that as a sports business, but particularly a rugby business?
To take your example of signing a big man like a Dan Carter, I think you sort of know what you're committing to. And, you know, your commercial deliveries are easier quantifiable on a signing like that, because he brings like a celebrity profile to the business. The big risk is where you have players like, let's use an example of the Sharks, do not have a go at other units. Afalele Fassi, for instance, who we took out of Dale College. And year two, I mean, he came in on a bursary. Year two, he shot the lights out. You know, now you've planned your player budget, but now you've got to accommodate this player, because he's now in a year gone from not on the radar to one of the top two in the country. And the year after, he's competing for a test match position, you know. So if you do a three-year plan, you could have never almost predicted that you're going to have that. And if you have one, that's manageable. But if you have five, six of them, yeah. it creates holes in the bucket.
I can imagine. And typically, what does the South African rugby franchise do? Do you go to the sponsors, ask them to dig a bit deeper to keep someone there? And they might see the value in that because the guy's profile and he brings, you know, value to their brand as well.
I think it depends on your business. I think the Bulls, as you mentioned earlier, that they've got two guys that they can knock on the door for. And I'm sure they'll get a favorable response. Yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah.
But we find ways.
I'm sure you do. And especially, I suppose it works the other way too. You've put a three-year plan in place for a guy and he doesn't develop or isn't as good as you thought he was. So I suppose the risk factor works the other way as well. Although in that case, you can try and offload him, although that would probably be at a loss compared to what you had budgeted for.
Yeah. And also, I think you've got to have probability cases for all these scenarios, you know. So like if you have a budget of, say, 100 rand, maybe in the first year spend 80 rand because you anticipate that you're going to have some of those outer lining players that are going to shoot the lights out, you know. So you leave some fat in your budget, but it's not easy.
And then, yeah, in terms of building a team, Ed, like the Sharks, as you said, before lockdown came, I think 6 out of 7 games you had won in Super Rugby, riding high. We'll talk a little bit about the team in a moment, but just in terms of building a team, what's to you as a CEO, and I know rugby decisions you'll leave to your rugby people in that sense, but yeah, you've got to do the budget, you've got to do the planning with them. What's most important? A very good coach, a very good academy, very good recruiting, a mix of all those things. How do you sort of build a team to deliver in a few years? Because it's not if you had an unlimited budget, you could buy 20 superstars and do what you like and hope for the best, but you look at Liverpool Football Club under Jurgen Klopp, took them sort of 4.5 years and they won the league. It was a steady progression. Is that kind of the model you look to as a business?
Craig, you know, the thing is, it's very hard to answer your question because you can look like a fool quite quickly, because we can say this is what we're doing and this is why we're successful. And then you have 2-3 games in a row where you get an absolute hiding, where sport's just an ultimate leveler. But I think what we've done at the Sharks, and it started with Gary. First of all, let me just pause on Gary Tashman for 10 seconds. I think he doesn't get enough credit. You know, he's an unbelievable guy who loves rugby and he's a good person. You know, strategically what he did, he settled a ship on the rough seas. And for the last 2 years under his guidance, I was allowed to put structures in place, you know, obviously with his input, into what I believe was going to be a sustainable future for the Sharks, you know. And I think if you look at 5 years ago, we had a top-down approach. we would go by the likes of a Willy LaRue, Jacques Potgieter, Michael Wenzel, you know, established really good players at a premium, bring them in to try and get a short-term fix. That didn't really work out so nicely for us. And, you know, when Gary and myself sat and spoke about it, I said, Gary, should we not do a bottom-up approach? You know, and he says, well, what do you suggest? And I said, well, let's rebuild our whole structure. And, you know, we created a structure for a player pathway. So it was, I think, 2018 when it was our first year. And Sean Everett was coaching the under-19 team. And the year before, so during 2017, we agreed on the structure. And we went and fetched the best under-19 players that suited our culture from all over the country. First of all, we started in the province, from all over the country. And we built accommodation at the stadium. And we really sort of almost raised them into through our culture, you know. And they were really a really strong squad. And we've done it now. We're in year three of that plan. And I think we're seeing the fruit from that structure now. So now you can bring one or two players like a Marnie Lubbock and a Werner Kock in. But the reality is you're going to have Jaden Hendricks, a Sanele Nahamba, Afalele Fassi, who actually come through your structure that's a fit with your culture. And I think that's from a structure point of view, what we've done in the last 3 years that's helped us a lot. And then also on the coaching side, I think what I believe is, I believe if your culture is strong enough and the structures are correct, then the head coach should come out of your system. And the reason why that's important is because he knows the players. He knows the guy who came here as a Dale first team fullback who never played Chrome because he was 19 in the trick, Fussy, and he knows the quality. You know, where if you bring maybe a coach from overseas, say, let's take any name, a Todd Blackadder, you won't know that. And he will then want to bring in his own assistants, his own medical, you know, a whole group of players, and that will cost a lot of money, you know. So I think from a business point of view, we had the structure on the player side that we've built that we're in year three now that's paying off for us. So the bottom-up approach. And then within our coaching structure, we've created a high-performance coaching environment where, you know, should Sean get promoted to coach the Springboks one day, you know, in our structure, we've got Brent Jansen van Rensburg, Dave Williams, Pierre Nonklomu, Etienne Finn, Michael Vowles, you know, like a lot of coaches that can step up knowing the culture. And I think that is our plan, to be honest with you.
And it sounds, you know, sensible. And I guess it sounds easier said than done. I'm sure it takes a lot of work to get all those things, you know, all those aspects working together, because people have personal ambitions. So a guy as an assistant coach sits behind Sean Everett, he might not want to hang around because there's other offers that come. And I suppose you have to deal with those kind of situations on a regular basis.
Yeah, and I think the easiest way to deal with those things is to be honest, you know, as part of our culture is, you know, we strive really hard to have a good culture at the Sharks, but one of the things is that it's not a soft culture. So, you know, my commitment to the staff and the players are that I will treat them unbelievably well. And if you unpack that, is my understanding of treating someone unbelievably well is to be honest with them, you know, and to have difficult conversations. So, yeah, that's the basis of what we build our franchise on.
Now, you've spoken about how you build a successful team, but what you've also managed to do, Ed, is build a brilliantly transformed team. And I mean that in the most basic sense in South African terms, in racially transformed, which is an important thing in South Africa. We've seen, we've seen that, and we've seen the Black Lives Matter movement come into sport. And the Sharks team has been wonderfully transformed. And you told me a story months ago, I think we spoke before lockdown, and you said, as an Afrikaans boy growing up in South Africa, I knew about apartheid and I knew it was wrong, but I was raised believing that rugby was a white man's sport. Now, maybe just take us a little bit through your personal journey, how you've come to sort of change your views over time and experience.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. I think, you know, my background is I was born in a little area called Bubsfontein on a farm. You know, my mom and dad, lovely people, but Afrikaans, and I'm Afrikaans. And, I'm very proud to be Afrikaans. You know, I'm not apologetic to be Afrikaans. I'm very proud. I went to Afrikaans Hoërskool School, Affies. And I'm very proud of my history. But you also get to a point in life where you start questioning things around you, you know. And I wanted to understand why certain things are, and you actually question yourself. And I married an unbelievable woman, Sarah is English. So from a culture point of view, I started seeing blended culture and trying to understand what it is to just look outside of your immediate surroundings, you know. And what I realized is that, you know, if you look outside, it doesn't mean that you discount what you're about or where you're from, you know. But you need to go and explore what's outside to understand what is the feeling that you're struggling with inside, you know. And I think that at the Sharks, we try and bring that to the fore. We've got Heritage Day tomorrow, and we've just launched a Isivavani monument, where the idea is it's at Johnson's Kings Park, and you can enter this monument from four directions, that, you know, like north, east, south, or west. And what it means, and what I said to the boys today, is like, we all come from our own direction. We all have our color, you know, unique color diversity, culture, background, and that's good. And we've got to celebrate that, you know, never be apologetic for where you're from, because it's who you are. It's what shaped you, you know. But if you come into the Sharks as a Vavani structure, you know, you've got to put your rock down. So I don't know if you know, Craig, but in Zulu, Isivavani literally means to put your stone up on the pile. And in the Zulu culture, one should never walk past a pile of rocks and not honor it, you know. So it's without adding a rock to the pile.
No, I didn't know. Okay.
You know, and I don't know. I actually studied a little bit, and the arrangement of the stones in Isivavani is contributed by diverse people over many years. And so another way of seeing Isivavani is a form of collectively performed memory.
Right.
In respect of the journey that you come from. And I've actually built a physical structure at the Sharks to say, like, listen, guys, we've got to have this collectively performed memory, you know, because that shapes our culture. That's what's going to make us strong. That's what's inclusivity.
Right.
You know, diversity through inclusivity means that we're a diverse group, but the inclusivity binds us. And the day you feel you can't be yourself at the Sharks, then our culture's failed, you know. So what the guys do is, like, and we had the ceremony this morning where each guy had a rock, and you can put whatever you can. We gave them a pen, and they can write whatever they want on the rock, and they can put the rock on the pile, you know. But if you put your rock down, it can, you know, mean a lot of things. You can let go of your weapon, your anxiety, or your fears. And, you know, if you look at Mandela's vision of the open hand, you know, that open hand is the same hand that held cold iron bars for 27 years, you know, that couldn't love or hold his family for 27 years. But yet it was the same hand that reached out to shake the hand of the enemy when he got released, you know. And that's what I said to the guys, you know, let's put our rock on the Sharks Isivavani pile.
Yeah.
And it just unifies us as a group, you know. So we really try and educate our players a lot, you know, because I don't want them to lose their individuality.
Yeah.
You know, but I want to buy into a greater cause of a diversity through inclusivity.
It's fascinating that you do that. And I guess, like anything, it stems from leadership. And I guess, as you say, players will come from very different backgrounds. Some will be hyper-conservative. Some will be, you know, the other way. And some will be party animals. And you've got to blend all these people into one unit. And I guess that's a constant evolving, I wouldn't say problem, but evolving challenge for you as leadership.
Yeah, Craig, it is. And you'll never control it. And controlling is the wrong word to use, but here's one way of managing it. So if your pathway and your structure is fine, you know, then the players that come through your pathway, like we have now in year three, will all be aligned with the Sharks vision, because the culture will spit out the guys that aren't. And I mean, you're going to get guys who are unbelievable record players, but they don't fit into your culture.
Yeah.
You know, and they will move on. So if we do our work right at the ground, and we formulate a culture and a structure, and this pipeline is healthy, and it produces top record players with the right culture, then you only have to bring one or two players in, you know. And over the last 2 years, I've made a point, so whenever a player signs to come to the Sharks, I go and see him in his hometown. You know, I drove to Bloem to see Oxenchair, Inga Finter. You know, I flew to Cape Town to see Van der Kock and Dan Uster. You know, like, because it's important. The only guy I didn't see, to be fair, is Monty Lubbock, because it was lockdown and the Bulls gave us a gift. So that was unbelievable. But I did apologize to him for that. But I've had him at our house since then. You know, but Madosh, I went to go see. James, I went to go see. Because they need to understand what they're coming into. You know, like we also, you know, significance versus success. So we've got Ubuntu that we lean on. I am because we are. You know, I can't be a good CEO if these players are all over the place and, you know, destroying culture and countercultural, you know, and they can't be good players if we don't run a solid business and can't pay them every month.
Again, it sounds simple and straightforward, but it's often not seen in business and in rugby in particular. We won't go pointing fingers at any rugby unions right now, but that is a challenge it's facing rugby though, Ed. Yeah, you touched on it there. My players came out with a fairly scathing statement recently, just about the fact that, you know, amateur unions are, you know, going into liquidation and then, you know, sort of re-emerging with another company, and players are being left as collateral damage, you know, through these companies closing. And I suppose the bigger picture here is, are we seeing a natural contraction of the rugby model? COVID might have accelerated it, but yeah, is this pie for rugby going to become smaller and more focused and consolidated?
I think the pie is the same, to be honest with you. I think it's just the slices you take out of the pie needs to maybe be equated a little bit different. It is tragic that players lose their jobs, you know, in a way that that happened. I wouldn't like to have too much to say about that. But, you know, I believe if you take the basic principles of governance and, you know, good corporate governance and you apply it into business, you know, listen, especially in a period like COVID, no one's bulletproof. You know, I think we've seen successful businesses take big hits and close down. So, you know, no one is bulletproof against COVID-19. But I think if you can see there's a lead up and there's sufficient red flags, your governance principles should kick in place and make sure that you don't trade recklessly in a way that you can expose people and you know have such a sad situation like that we're dealing with now, because it does affect the industry, it affects the image of the industry, you know, and for South African rugby, and sorry, it's not good, because, you know, last year we won the World Cup and there's a positive narrative and feel around it. And I think for them too, it must be extremely frustrating to have these things.
Ed, I don't know how much you can say about the future structure of the game, but I mean, I understand through people I've spoken to that the four South African sort of Super Rugby franchises with SANS are, I wouldn't say breaking up completely, but certainly splintering slightly, that we are now scheduled to end up playing European rugby in a Pro 16 format, but SANS will still continue at a sort of a test level. I don't know how you're going to answer this, but just your sort of broad sort of feelings on the future of rugby as it relates to the Sharks, really, where you're going to be playing, or how do you feel about where you're going to be playing, or what possibilities are on the table?
Hey, Craig, I'm so disappointed I actually agreed to this podcast, because I thought you were going to tell me what's happening.
Well, I can tell you what I know, and then you can tell me what you know. Well, look, I've heard the Pro 16 is going to happen with the South African 4 franchise. Of course, that hasn't been confirmed anywhere yet. So let's put that in the realms of 50-50 informed opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, Craig, to be honest, I don't have a defined direction where we're going. We're in the process of having those discussions. You know, but I look at the Sharks and you know, what we've achieved in the last 25 years. I think Brian Fonsell did an unbelievably good job in taking his team and taking the Sharks from the Banana Boys into this brand that's, you know, like, if you look at research, one of the strongest brands in provincial world rugby. You know, so I think from a point of view, we're excited to go wherever there's a challenge. And, you know, I think personally as a player, I played in Super Rugby. So, you know, there'll definitely be if that is the reality that's finished now, I think that'll be sad in a way that there's a lot of good memories. But like anything, one thing in sport that's a constant is change. So I'm sure that whatever competition structure is going to be announced, I'm sure it'll be exciting for fans. And, you know, the thing is, if we play North, all I can say, I think just it'll be more equitable in terms of travel, because you want to play in competitions you can win. And there's no ways that South African rugby teams are, you know, I think South African rugby, the Bulls have won Super Rugby 3 times and that's the only team in 20 years.
Yeah, 25 years, yeah.
Yeah, in 25 years. And there's no ways that we are 3 out of 25-year country. You know, we've won the World Cup.
Exactly, we won the World Cup 3 times in 25 years.
Yeah. But the reality is, if you finish second in Super Rugby, you know, you go play away against a team like the Crusaders, you get there on a Wednesday evening,
yeah,
you know, you jet lagged and you hang on for first half and then you end up losing. And we saw that with an unbelievably strong Lions team 3 years in a row, you know, where they dominated the competition. They slipped up somewhere through Super Rugby, finished second and had to go and play abroad, or, you know, like had to travel, and that affected them. So I think from a logistics point of view, North should be better.
Yeah.
And I think also from a broadcast point of view, it might be, because you'll have more games in prime time. So yeah, listen, I don't have all the information and the answers. I hopefully we'll have it soon so we can do our planning for 2021. But yeah, I think it's exciting.
Absolutely. And I think on that note, Ed, it's been really interesting. Thanks for giving us some insights into just the business of running a rugby franchise in this country. And yeah, all strength to the Sharks. Best of luck in the new competition and the way forward. And hopefully you come join us again when we know what the new competition structure looks like.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. And I think it's an exciting new competition starting. You know, we're sending a young team to Loftus, which can go either way. But, you know, we've got such talented youngsters and we need to see what they can do. So, yeah, I'm excited about the season ahead. I think our boys are just like racehorses waiting for the gates to open. So hopefully they just don't exhaust themselves in the first 10 minutes. But yeah, it's exciting times. And I think it's, you know, it's just a beacon of hope for a nation that sports starting again, because, you know, it distracts people from their realities.
Absolutely. Ed Goodsir, thanks so much for your time. Good to chat.
Thanks, Craig.
This podcast is made possible by our Maverick Insiders. Please consider becoming part of our Maverick Insider community, where for a nominal fee every month, you are supporting quality independent journalism. You also get some cool benefits such as Uber vouchers and engagement with our journalists thrown in. Please go to dailymaverick.co.za/insider to sign up and become part of the Maverick Insider community. And also remember to sign up to our Maverick Sports newsletter, which hits your inbox on a Monday, and never miss another podcast by signing up via your favorite platform. I'm Craig Ray. Thanks for joining us this week.